Okay, let me just very quickly say thank you for those that have remembered and thought of Sandra in your prayers and all the cards and whatever that you sent. She's really doing quite remarkably well, I think. Tuesday night when they first brought her up out of the surgery, I thought that was the last I'd ever see of her. It made me sick. Made Charlie sick, broke my heart. But the Lord has been good. Every day there's been really significant improvement. So my only fear now is she's going to think she's feeling better than she really is and do something, bust all that stuff open. I don't want to be there when that happens. But the Lord has been most gracious, and I do appreciate all of your kindness in her behalf. Now today is somewhat of a transition day. We finished the confession last Lord's Day, and I thought today I would take any questions that you would like to have discussed, things that have been on your mind. I did not get many. Perhaps other things will come up today if we have time. But I did have some questions submitted to me, and so I thought I would address these, and then, Lord willing, next week we'll begin, I think, a book study. We have done various things over the years. I think I'll commence a book study. I'm going back and forth right now in my mind between doing theological analysis of the book of Exodus or Isaiah. I don't know. I haven't really quite settled. Any preferences? What do you want? You want Isaiah? How many want Isaiah? How many want Exodus? Who doesn't care? All right, we'll see. That was about half and half, so I don't know. I'll just take that I need to pray a little more to see which way to go. But either Exodus or Isaiah will begin, Lord willing, next week. All right, so let me just address then some of these questions that have been given to me, and if we have time, if you have anything else that this generates, we'll discuss those as well. The first question, I think we can handle this very quickly. This was given to me this morning by someone I won't mention, but he's taping right now. Why do most preachers have insufferable egos? I thought that was a good question. And unfortunately, one that apparently is all too true. Answer very easy. It's sin. All right. It is sin, pure and simple. One of the great requirements of a minister is that he recognizes his insufficiency and his inherent inabilities, and that he can do nothing apart from the ministry of the Spirit of God in fulfilling his particular ministry. But it is true. There are many out there. I hope we don't have any here, although it may sound like it at times, but we don't. But there are many out there, I think, that do have an idea about themselves that God's kingdom cannot survive apart from them. And it's not true. It is certainly not true. I think there's a misinterpretation of a verse that is said concerning the patriarchs in their prophetic ministries. Touch not the Lord's anointed. That's a word of protection and a word of preservation that God had promised to those patriarchs in fulfilling of his word of promise to them. But I think many preachers take that verse out of context, not the least of one they take out of context usually, and apply it to themselves, and therefore, I'm your spiritual leader. Don't ever, ever question anything I say. And that flat out, Doc, is sin. All right, it's sin. So that's an easy question. So if you see a preacher with an ego, you know he's a sinner and needs to listen to his own preaching. Well, maybe that's the problem. All right, next question. Next question concerns a statement in Ecclesiastes. So turn to Ecclesiastes. think some years ago I took you through the book of Ecclesiastes, did a study of this book. And this question concerns the statement in chapter 3 and verse 11. Ecclesiastes 3:11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. And the question concerns the word that the Authorized Version translates as world. The issue concerns a study that has been made by this individual that sees this word as eternity, or at least some translations, commentaries, see this word as eternity and others don't. So what is the issue? What has God set in man's heart? Has he set the world, or has he set eternity? This is a key verse, all right? I'm sore tempted, I think, those of you that have been under my ministry over the years know how I love this book of Ecclesiastes. It is a fantastic book. It is a book that sets down for us what the proper philosophy of life is for believers. It is not a book. It is not a book that is just the record of man's reasoning and man's own estimations of things that therefore we are to ignore. I detest that view of this book. This book is inspired. It is that which is given. We are told by the one shepherd, the Lord God himself. These are words of truth. They are words that are to be followed. We have here a divinely inspired philosophy of life. What is our view of life to be? And as believers, God does not leave us guessing, even as to what our philosophy of life ought to be. The Word of God is perfect. It's complete. God tells us everything that we need to know for our eternal destinies, and that is good. And he reveals to us everything that we need to know for every aspect of our day-by-day existence, even how we view life. Now, Ecclesiastes, then, is dealing with that issue. And I would mark, and if you recall the earlier studies that we have done in this book, I think I probably marked 3:11 as the key verse for the entire message of this poetical book. The bottom line is that if we are to have a proper view of life, we must put life and all of the things of life within the perspective of eternity. That this life is not all there is. That anyone that lives for this life, whether it's the pleasures of life, whether it is the fruit of life, the materials of life, the labor of life, the relationships of life, if all that we have in life is this life and the things of this life, we are going to greatly be at sea, and we're going to flounder, and there will never be peace. There will never be contentment in the things of this life, because everything in this life is transient. Everything in this life is temporary. That's why we are never satisfied. That's why you can never be satisfied if you are looking for contentment. And if you are looking for peace and for joy in the things of life, and you know that by experience, why is it that in those things that we want, all right, we all have this little wanter within us, and that's part of life, all right? There are things that we want, and we strive, we save, we do whatever, and we get those things that we want, and it's not long before that which we thought would be the ultimate satisfaction for us, we got what we wanted, and now we want something else. And if we're trying to find, if we think that getting something is what is going to satisfy us in life, we are going to be completely frustrated. And that's where the world is, isn't it? All right, there's where the world is. The world is living for now. And the world is living for the things of now. And they're always trying to experience. They're trying to gain this or gain that with the hope that if I can just get this, if I can just experience this, that is going to give to me the peace and the comfort and the contentment that is a natural desire of life. And it doesn't happen. They get that, and then their wanter kicks in again, and they're wanting something else. And again, that's part of life. And I think the fact that our wanters, all right, the fact that our wanters are never satisfied, and our wanters are never going to be made content, is a good reminder to us that the things of this life, and this life in and of itself, is not what is going to bring contentment. It's not what is going to bring joy and satisfaction. It's a vice, some say. I think it's a great virtue of mine that I like to hunt, right, and this kind of stuff. And I like guns, all right? I like guns, and I have various guns of various sort. I told Sanders that there's one more, right? There's one more. If I just get this one more, that'll complete my collection, and I'll be satisfied. All right? I just want the one more. I've said that about five or six times now, right? And now there's another one I want, right? And that's just the way life is. I'm not going to find satisfaction in those things. And whatever it is that you want, all right? Some of you have less noble wants than I do. And you'll get those, and it's not going to satisfy you. Now, why is that? Why is it that the things of this life, no matter how good they are or how great they are not going to satisfy us? Because there is something about man. There is something about man that inherently cannot be satisfied with the stuff of time. Why is that? Well, I think chapter 3, verse 11 brings us to that clue. God, and you put this in the context here, all of these times that God has ordered. Chapter 3 here is a powerful passage that reminds us of the absolute sovereignty of God. And the eternal purpose of God that has determined all of the times and the circumstances and the events of our lives. There is a time for every season, for to everything there is a season, and to a time to every purpose under the heaven. There is a God upon the throne, and this God has determined, not fatalistically, but this God, out of His good providence, who knows all, who has purposed all from His divine wisdom and His infinite goodness, has determined the end from the beginning in all of the circumstances of our lives. And you go through this section, and you can see all of these times that God has determined. A time to be born, a time to die. That's fixed. The time of our birth is fixed. And the time of our death is fixed. From a human perspective, we talk about untimely births and untimely deaths. We talk about premature births. I heard that all the time when my own sons were born. They got here before they were supposed to, as far as the calendar was concerned. And they called them premies. I hated that. All right, I hated that. I guess that's what they just call them, right? They're preemies. But there's something about that that just irked me. Here comes this. Oh, I won't go into that. Preemies. They weren't preemies, all right? There's no such thing as a premature birth. No such thing. It may be premature as far as the normal calendar system is concerned, but not in God's eternal purpose. And there's no such thing as a premature death. Oh, we talk about those that died before their time, a premature... No such thing. No such thing. The time of our birth is fixed. The time of our death is fixed. And it is unalterable. We trust the Lord in regard then to all of the things in between as well. I'm not going to go through all of those times, obviously. But it's leading up. It's leading up to the text that we're considering. Here are all of these times and all of these circumstances that God has fixed and God has determined. We trust Him, therefore, and we enjoy, therefore, and we use, therefore, all of these times. I am sore tempted to hit a couple of these on our way down to verse 11. But these are times that God has fixed, and you'll notice there's a time. There is a time for joy, a time for laughing, and a time for weeping. And I think sometimes, and I know I've addressed this before, but let me hit it again while I'm here. I think sometimes we get this notion of the providence of God. We're Calvinists. All right? We're Calvinists. We believe in the providence of God. And therefore, because I'm a Calvinist, because I believe in the providence of God, that God is sovereign, therefore I am to face every circumstance of life with this stoicism, with this boldness of heart, and I'm going to stick this through because God is... Well, God is sovereign. But stoicism is not a response to the sovereignty of God. You see. That's a response to fatalism. All right? That's a response to fatalism, but we're not fatalistic. God has made us. And all of these times are those times that God has made. And there is a time for weeping as there is a time of laughing. And when God brings in the difficulties of life, the troubles of life, the sorrows of life, God does not expect us, and God has not purposed for us to smile and to laugh and to be giddy in the times of sorrow. See? When a tragedy comes, when a death comes to our family, when there's sickness in our family, He expects us to weep. He expects us to weep. Weeping is not a sign that we don't believe in the providence of God. It is not a rebellion. And I talk to people, and I've known circumstances where there's been a tragedy, but, oh, if I grieve over this, that's a sign I don't trust God. That's a sign that I'm rebelling against God's will. No, it's not. No, it's not. God expects us to weep in the weeping times. Right? And He expects us to laugh in the laughing times. And thank God there's both of those times. There's both of those times that He brings into our life. And we are to respond. Our response to the providence of God is a faithful demonstration of how He demands that we respond. You understand what I'm saying? He doesn't expect us to stand over the casket of a loved one and say, ha ha, thank God that's over, you know, whatever. You know, these stupid Presbyterian jokes that are out there. That's no sir. No sir. That's fatalism. All right, and that is not a sign of trust. That is a sign of trying to build myself. I'm going to take through this, and I... No, no. God expects us to weep. All right, God expects us to weep in the weeping times. So you go through those, and they're great lessons. But all of this is leading then to this key verse, verse 11. Here, all of these times, He hath made everything beautiful. That word beautiful could well be translated appropriate. God has made everything appropriate. In His time. Also, He had set the world in their heart. Now, this word world is the word that most, I think, everywhere else. I could be wrong here. I think this is the only place. Rhett, can you help me here? Is this word ever translated world anyplace else? I think this is the only place in the Authorized Version that this particular word is ever translated as world. And it is the world that virtually every place else is translated eternity, is translated everlasting. It is the word that when we talk of God eternal, the eternal God, this is the word. All right, this is the word. And as I say, I believe this is the only time in the Authorized Version where it is ever translated as world. Everywhere else, eternal, I say it's the term that describes eternity. It's the term that describes the everlasting God, El Nolam, the God of eternity, the everlasting Father. All right, that's the word. All right, that's the word. So I think when we put all of the evidence together, this word, I think naturally here, should be the sense of eternity as well. That God has set eternity. Now, let's plug that in. Don't take that in isolation. You put that within the whole message of Ecclesiastes. We're looking for that place of ultimate contentment. We're looking for that which is ultimately going to satisfy. If God has set eternity, then in my heart. And are we eternal? All right? Are we immortal? All right? Not physically, but we don't believe in annihilation. When we die, that's not the end of us. All right? There is a life beyond. I don't care whether you're saved or whether you're lost. You understand what I'm meaning here. There is a life that goes on. All right? This life is not the end of things. This life is not the end of things for believers. And this life is not the end of things for unbelievers. Life goes on. Either in God's presence, as we considered in the confession in these closing chapters. That life goes on either in the presence of God, or that life goes on in eternal death, if you will, in the place of torment. But this life is not all there is. There is a life beyond. God has made us. God has made us immortal, not physically, but He has put within us this desire and this inherent eternality. That is why, ultimately, why is it that I cannot find satisfaction in the things of time? Because they pass and they move, and there is that which is within us that drives us, therefore. This book is greatly evangelistic, Ecclesiastes. Because it's teaching us ultimately that the only thing that can satisfy that eternity within my heart is that which is eternal. See? The only thing that can satisfy me is that which is eternal. And the only thing, the only one then that can ultimately satisfy is God Himself. This book drives us to God. And it's only then a relationship with God. It's only as we fear God, that great term of Christian experience that is the conclusion of this book, that we are going to have the ultimate satisfaction and the ultimate contentment in the things of life. We enjoy life, and this is why Ecclesiastes tells us, you enjoy life. Hey, this life is good. The life that God gives to us, He gives to us to enjoy. And you can see that particular theme, enjoy life. Enjoy life, but don't think life is going to be the end of all things. And don't think this experience or this possession or whatever else is going to be that which gives the ultimate contentment. But God has given us life as a gift. It's the gift of life. It's the gift of my wife. It's the gift of my labor. It's the gift of my family. All of these things that God has given to me. Now, why does God give? He doesn't give us those things to make us miserable. He doesn't give us those things to make life a burden for us. No, He gives us those things that we might enjoy. That we might enjoy. That we might be content. And that's the great idea of contentment, see. Be content. Be content with the life that God has given to you. Now, my life may not be what yours is, you see. And your life may not be what mine is. But the life that I have, the family that I have, the things that I have are what God has given to me. Let me realize that He is the giver of all things. There's nothing that I have that is not the manifestation of His goodness to me. Let's be content then. There's going to be discontent if I look at what you have and say, how come? You say, no. We look at what God has given to us, the fact that He has made us, that we are His creature, that we are His children, and what He gives us and what He does for us is for our good. He's not given us this life to be miserable. See, God's not trying. And I think Christians sometimes have this notion that one of the reasons that we're going to get to heaven ultimately is because, you know, we've gone through such a stinking life. You see, and God kind of owes it to us. All right, to make up for all the stinking stuff we went. No. The life that we have is good. Oh, there may be trouble. There may be adversities. Don't think that a good life is a life that is free from adversity. You see, this great text that I've referred to hundreds of times, I'm sure, is one that, you know, brings this home to me over and again in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. That's easy to do. All right, that's easy to do. But in the day of adversity, think about this, consider. God also has set the one over against the other to the end that man should find nothing after him. That's the key. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And I say it doesn't take a great deal of spiritual maturity to rejoice when everything is going well. But in the day of adversity, the Lord says, I want you to think about this. God has set the one against the other. What's he talking about? God has set this day of adversity right smack up against the day of prosperity. God juxtaposes the good days and the bad days, the joyful days and the days of adversity. He puts those two right up together for this purpose, that man might find nothing after him. Make sure you get a big H on that word. That man might find nothing after him. Becomes a way of reminding us that this life is not what it's all about. That we are dependent upon him. What is going to satisfy that eternity within me? It is my relationship with the eternal God. He reminds us. I suppose if we were a bit brighter, right? If we were a bit brighter and a bit more spiritually astute, we would always recognize our dependence upon God in the good times. But you know and I know. And it's not just us. We have examples after example of this in the Word of God. There's a tendency in our stupidity that when everything is going well, to give our little salute to God. But where's the dependence? And you look at your little life, and I look at my little life. And is it not as we look back in those days of adversity, where we know the nearness of God and we know the consolation of God and we know that dependence upon God, we were brought to that sense of dependence upon God, that in the good days we just kind of have our devotion and say, thank you, Lord. But when the times are going tough, so often we are brought to that consciousness that I am dependent upon. Now, I'm dependent upon God in the good days as well. But I'm saying, and you know what I'm saying, I think, that it's when we're brought to the end of ourselves. We're brought to the end of ourselves. And we're reminded again, I am dependent upon God. Well, let that be a lesson that even in the good days we recognize that dependence as well. Let's see. This last week has been a good week for me. It's been a good week in many ways for me. One of those odd good weeks. All right, my wife didn't die. All right, that was good. Other things happened that just reminded me of, you know, how good God is. But he's good all the time. You know, he's good all the time. Dependence. All right, have I answered that question? I don't know. Here's the eternity. The only thing, this book is driving us to God, you see. It's driving us to God. The only thing that can satisfy that immortality that God has put within us is a relationship with him. If I'm not saved, you see, if I don't have that relationship with the eternal God, why is it that life then becomes... We can well understand why this life is such a constant rat race and why this life is such a constant quest for things. You see? And the tragedy is that so many Christians get taken up into that rat race. And they get taken up into that quest for material things and for experience and for... If I can just then... it's our relationship with God that is the... is the key thing. So he has made. He set eternity, I do believe, in our hearts. As I say, this is the only place in the Authorized Version that I can recall, and the Kinrep can recall, that the word is actually translated as world. And why they did it, I don't know. Tell you the truth. Okay, does that answer that question more or less? Buddy with me there? Okay. All right, I love Ecclesiastes. If I hadn't already done that with you, I'd do that. I'd do it every year if I could. Love that book. All right, a question I can answer here very quickly, I think, because I'm ignorant. What is meant by the term progressive dispensationalism, and is there biblical data to support such a position? This gets, you know, perhaps more specialized than we want to get into in this class. There is a move in dispensationalism. We've talked about dispensationalism. It's come up in various of our discussions. Kimbrough has written his little book on dispensationalism, and you know that's good. Let me just say this: this dispensationalism, even its worst, is not the enemy to Christianity. All right. And I think this, we tend to polarize these things. I'm not a dispensationalist in that traditional sense of the word. But people, let's understand that they are Christians, all right, the most of them. And covenant theologians are Christians, the most of them, all right? But they are not, they ought not be enemies one with the other. And I must say it grieves me when these are set up as the great battle lines, of truth. We have differing opinions and differing interpretations, and I don't like some of their presuppositions. I don't like some of their conclusions, and I've dealt with them. But that's an interpretational issue. I would like this here to maintain some degree of Christian unity on this. We differ on certain things. All right, we differ on certain things, but we tend to become so polarized sometimes. Here's Calvinism and Arminianism, and we, on both sides, will hurl accusations against the other. Well, we have, I don't like some of what they say, and they don't like some of what I say, but Wesley is in heaven. I believe that with all my heart. All right? I believe that with all my heart. So let's not, be so proud of our little labels that we jump off and start attacking. And this has become, I think, an issue on covenant and dispensationalism. You read some of the stuff, and it's the great enemy. All right? It's the great gospel enemy. I don't like what some of they do, but that's part of it. But whatever. There is a traditional dispensationalism. Back in the Schofield era, which is evidenced by Ryrie. I think it's Ryrie today would be the classic representation of best known representation of that classic form of dispensationalism. But even Ryrie has moved away from some of the really bad stuff that you see in Schofield's statements and whatever. If you look at the new Schofield Reference Bible in contrast with the old Schofield Reference Bible, some of the really stupid notes are not there. That they've taken away some of those. And that's good. That's good. But there is always an adjustment in the theological schemes. Well, there has been over the last few years a redefining of dispensationalism and dispensational theology that is typically referred to as progressive dispensationalism. And this particular trend or move in dispensationalism has really quite upset some of the traditional dispensationalists. And in many ways, and I'll just put it this way, because I'm going to confess here, I've not done a bunch of reading and I'm not really quite up on all of the implications and whatever else. But my general feeling is that in this move that is designated as progressive dispensationalism, there's a redefining and a moving back towards some of the presuppositions and statements that we typically associate with covenant theology. Does that be your assessment, right, of what's basically going on? Recognition that some of the statements concerning the dichotomy, the absolute dichotomy between Israel and the church, had gone too far. A realization that some of the, therefore, consequential statements concerning the method of salvation in the Old Testament had gone too far. And it's a move back in many ways to what traditionally might be termed as covenant theology. And I say that it's a growing debate and has been, I say, over the last the last few years. But I'll have to confess, I've not done much reading and research into the area to go into many specifics. But bottom line, that seems to be what it is: a redefining of some of the terms and a closer conciliation with what has been traditional Reformed and covenant theology. But if you see that term, if you can see that term, you'll know at least basically what it refers to. Well, whatever. That's about all I can say. It's about all I know about it. Okay? Yeah.
You know any names?
Craig Blazing, Daryl Bach, both at Dallas. I think Bach is at Southern Seminary in Louisville right now as a visiting professor. Yeah. They're the two big names out of Dallas.
Dallas, of course, has been the traditional bulwark of dispensationalism over the years. Ryrie, of course, is from Dallas, and Schaefer, and all of these traditional dispensations. But it seems to be, I'm confessing ignorance here because, frankly, I've not had a lot of interest to get into to looking at it. But the overview, I think, is a redefining and an elimination of some of the really the offensive parts and aspects of what we would be opposed to in dispensationalism. Okay? All right, good. All right, another question that I have here. Some Christians are determined to institute Old Testament biblical law. Others emphasize the truth that we are pilgrims and not to be involved in the civil sphere. Others are confused. Since I'm in the last category, could you please speak to this question? Well, here's someone who, at least from our opening question, may be qualified for the ministry. Who knows, huh? All right, this is a very widespread question, and it's a legitimate question, and it's one that has plagued the church from the get-go. What is the relationship between the Old Testament law and New Testament life? And it's a question that we have addressed, I think, from time to time. And we may have hinted on it even to some degree last week. And you have extremes, and then you have a moderate position, obviously. The question here reflects the two extremes. You have those that are typically, at least today, associated with that Reconstructionism or theonomist view that I referred to in passing last week in looking at the various eschatological positions, that would maintain that anything that God says, no matter how specific it is, in which He says it, by which He says it, that is necessarily to be implemented in the day in which we live. So all of the civil laws in the Old Testament are legitimately and necessarily to be applied to the church. You have, and not just to the church, but to society in general. And then you have the other extreme that basically take Romans 6, 14 or 17, whatever it is, out of context. We're not under law, but under grace, and therefore conclude that anything that has to do with law is no longer appropriate or applicable in the day in which we live, and therefore we are to be separate, that the church, the separation of church and state mentality, therefore that we are, as he says here in the question, pilgrims, and therefore we have and are to exercise no kind of control or influence in the world in which we live. Now, I would submit to you that both of those extremes are extremes, and therefore not the appropriate way to look at this issue. And I find interestingly that both of those extremes are making the same the same hermeneutical mistake. I think they're making the same hermeneutical mistake, but then applying it differently. Now, when we talk about the law, you have various aspects of law, and I know we've addressed this before. The greatest commandments, all right, and I think to understand this, we have to put this in the perspective and how the Lord works here. What is the greatest commandment? What is the greatest commandment? Love the Lord our God with all of our heart and soul and strength. All right, that's the greatest of all of the commandments. And the second is like unto it, Christ says, what? Love your neighbor as yourself. Now, those two summary commandments, I submit to you, encompass every other commandment and every other instruction that God gives to us in His Word. That is the umbrella statement that encompasses everything. Now, we have put a great emphasis here, and we've gone over this in our confession from time to time, on the Ten Commandments. This is today's. The Ten Commandments, we say, are the summary statement of the moral law. But this is the next level, if you will, of specificity. The greatest commandment, love the Lord our God with all of our hearts. Second like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. You look at the Ten Commandments, it's the next level of specificity in terms of that moral law. The first four commandments, dealing with who we are to worship, how we are to worship, that's under what? What commandment is that? That's under love the Lord our God with all of our heart. Commandments 6 through 10, honoring our parents, not killing, not being adulterous, not waterboarding, whatever. What is that? That's loving your neighbor as yourself. All right. Here's a more specific statement. And I would submit to you, therefore, that every other command or instruction or prohibition that God gives to us in His Word, if we think, we ought to be able to relate to one of the Ten Commandments. All right. Ought to be able to relate it to one of the Ten Commandments, and then in turn to the next higher statement, either loving God completely or loving our neighbor as ourselves. It all fits. Now, what we have in the Word of God, particularly in the Old Testament, is a very high level of specificity, if I can use that word, a very high level of specificity. When we have a commandment concerning how we're to harvest our crop and how we are to groom ourselves and what garments we are to wear in this and that and the other. A very high level of specificity. Now, that is, on the one hand, part of the problem with the Old Testament, but I think on the other hand, it's part of the solution to us as how to use the how to use the moral law and how to use the Ten Commandments. Because it demonstrates that the moral law of God, when I see that high level of specificity, it demonstrates to me and declares to me that the law of